Hello again, and welcome to Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway. I'm Dylan Langell, and thank you for pressing play at riversidespeedway.ca or clicking download on iTunes. If you missed it, last episode I got to chat with NASCAR legend Kenny Wallace, who will be the guest driver at the IWK 250, as well as track owner Donald Chisholm. Oh, how I can almost smell the burning rubber. As we get closer to the season opener in June, we now have more details about the first race of the season, and now we have the entertainment all lined up for the IWK 250 tailgate party. I'll chat with General Manager Paul McLean about the latest news, but first, we are joined by one of the greatest drivers in the Maritimes. The number of wins he has is in the triple digits, and a lot of those wins came right here at Riverside. Frank Frazier is my guest on episode number 3 of Victory Laps, and while we talk a lot about his career at Riverside, we also talk about his son, Scott Frazier. He is a racer, a race car builder, team owner, promoter, race director, vice president of the Maritime Motorsports Hall of Fame, sounds like a jack of all trades and an overall good guy. It's Frank Frazier on the third episode of Victory Laps. How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing fine.
Well, it's good to be talking to you. How's winter 2019 treating you?
Long and boring.
Yes. I think we all want to get back to the racetrack.
My wife went away down south, and I usually don't go, and I said, this year, I think I should have went.
I don't blame you, but one way to escape the heat is, you know, reminiscing about some of the memories of racing at Riverside. It's the 50th anniversary, and that's the whole idea for the Victory Laps podcast.
Well, it that track's been around a long while, and it's gone through more or less like three different stages where John built it, and then he sold it, and then he bought it back and probably made one of the best facilities and as good a facility as anywhere in North America as far as I'm concerned. So it's kind of made the full circle.
Absolutely. But let's just quickly talk about your beginnings in racing. How did you get started in this wonderful venture?
Well, it kind of happened a long, long time ago where I did some drag racing and I didn't get into that as much. And then from near St. John, I was living in Moncton, and I moved back down, and a buddy I hung around with, he decided that we should build a stock car, and they had two tracks going down there at that time, and I went there, and the first night I run the first heat race, I won it, and I think it kind of hooked me on it, and I've been in it ever since.
What kind of car were you driving the first time?
It was either 55 or 56 Ford. We bought two of them down the road and from where he was, and we drove one would drive, so we drove one and towed the other back to a friend's place. He put a cage in it. We built the first car I ever built. It cost us $85, and the first night I raced with it, we made $65.
Oh, you almost broke even.
Had a good night.
So let's skip ahead a little bit. 1969, that's when John Chisholm builds Riverside, modeled after Bristol Motor Speedway, a third of a mile. How do you hear about this behemoth of a track going in James River?
Well, we were racing down here then at the old Drag City track, and it happened just a couple years before that. So we were well aware of what was going on in the area. And back in them days, we actually had a stock car association, and I was president of it at the time. So it was just known everywhere.
And what was your first thoughts the first time you go to Riverside International Speedway?
It was probably the biggest, the size of the track and the banking of the track. That's what, when you grow up in New Brunswick and I run all the short tracks up there, they're more like Scotia size, quite a bit smaller, and then they had the Lucasville track that was a half-mile deal, but Annie Ganesh, with the banking and the speed that you had there, it's a fun track for a race car driver. That's the best way I can describe it, and it's just very challenging and a lot of fun to drive at.
So was it almost challenging for a driver if they were never on a high bank circuit, like just to go from, you know, like you said, like a short bank, short track to almost a super speedway here in the Maritimes?
Really, to tell you the truth, that track is when you first get there, it sort of dictates how you drive, and you go out on the racetrack, and I've done it years later when I've had a lot of experience. You go out there, and the car feels good, and it feels great, and you go out there, and you're driving around, and you come in, they think you're really good, and they tell you you're a half a second slow, and you can't believe it. It kind of it's easy to drive up to maybe 90% of the speed, and then it becomes very difficult. So it can kind of lull you to sleep a little bit. So it wasn't a hard track to get used to. It's just a hard track to get fast on.
When was the first time you raced at Riverside?
Now, you'd have to go back to the people that keep track of history. I was there, I believe, the very first race that they run there. That's as far as my recollection goes. And I was running for a guy here in Lower Sackville, and basically I think I pretty well, you know, I've raced there pretty well every year since.
So let's skip ahead again. 1977 is when the 250 lap race is introduced. Normally, how long were the races at Riverside before the 250 was introduced?
There was hardly any races in the Maritimes, much more than 100 laps in those days, because the cars we had weren't built to run a long time anyway. The technology and reliability in them back was way, way, way less than it is now. So, you know, like it's same as in the old days. That I used to run four times a week in the Maritimes, and most of the races I run were 25-lap features. So it was 100 lap then was a long time. Now it's sort of the norm and much more. So when you went to 250, like I think if you check back in the history books, they broke it, they split it up halfway just to give the guys a rest, you know, because it was a lot harder and a lot more physical to drive them cars than it is today.
And do you have any memories of racing that first 250?
No, actually I don't. That's the weird. I've been raced so many times so often, I guess I didn't do anything stupid that day, so I don't remember.
Well, how about 1978 when you win the 250 race? How did it feel to win such a long race?
Hey, it was good. By that time, I'd been winning quite a bit anyway, but the 250 in Antigonish was kind of special, and it always is. It's in the Maritimes. The 250 in Antigonish in the Maritimes was like the Maritimers going to the Oxford 250. It was the place you had to go.
Do you recollect how many cars were like around then in the 70s, late 70s for the 250?
I don't remember numbers, but there was more cars back. Like you take the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot more cars in the Maritimes than there is today. But they were, even for those, the day and the time and what the dollar was worth, they were much cheaper to build. Like each track, you know, like there was probably, I don't know, I'm just off the top of my head, probably 8 to 10 tracks in the Maritimes. And each one had a top class that probably had 25 or 30 cars, and they run every week. So it was, most times you went to any bigger races, you had to qualify, and it was quite difficult to qualify because it was just people could afford it. And, you know, those were the days when the young fellows at my age, everybody was beating and looking at cars and working at cars, and the cars was their whole thing, and it was a sort of a natural progression to get into racing.
Now, in 1987, that's when you win the 250 race again. Do you have any memories of that race, the 1987 race?
It's usually 250s go, you know, pretty, they're kind of usually flow along. You usually have a flow to them, and a lot of time, because they're so long, you don't remember. I remember more of the 250 when Scott was running there, and he had won a whole bunch of them in a row, and I was running at the time, and it was a 250, and I caught him and was just about to go by him, and I dropped the cylinder in the motor, and I ended up still running second. But I remember that more than any, because I said I spent 100 laps trying to catch the little bugger, and just at the time I caught him and drove up underneath him to go by, it dropped the cylinder. That's the one I remember more than anything.
Oh, and I was actually going to jump ahead of that. So Scott had Riverside down. He won 5 250 races in a row. As a competitor and a dad, you're racing against your son. Like, how do you feel that he's winning 5 in a row? I'm sure you would have liked to have been in that position.
Well, see, we've sort of had a career that kind of copied each other in some ways. I won 650 or the international races at River Glade, which was the big race in the 60s and early 70s. I won 6 of those. We were similar, but to me, the big thing was when he got on that streak, I was still racing, and I wanted to end the damn streak. I'm sorry, he might be my kid, but I still wanted to beat him.
And besides the 97 race, were you two door handle close every time, or did he dominate almost every time?
he pretty well dominated every time. He had the ability. He had the natural feel. He had the talent. He had a lot of help. You know, he had a lot of good help with Henley and sponsors and Rolly McDonald and he grew up with me. He understood. By the time he got into a race car, he understood racing completely. Then it's like Terry Clattenburg's son, Dean, Scott Kelly's. They grew up in it, and when they got into cars, they'd been around and heard so much about it, they just naturally did it.
So what did it mean to you to be able to race alongside Scott? I mean, it's great. It was great for me being a young hockey player playing with my dad, and now being on the racetrack. I can imagine maybe the same feeling.
Yeah, like my oldest son said, we probably run each other harder than we've done anybody else on the racetrack. But no, it was good. I mean, it's hard to describe a race car driver, but I mean, when you're racing, he's just one more guy to beat. It really is, and it's like when the boys from down south come up and somebody say to me, you know, what's it like to run against these people? I said, it's just one more guy to beat on the racetrack. So when you're on a track, it's a whole different deal. But, you know, even when we were racing against each other, when something happened on the racetrack, I was always wondering if I wasn't in it, I was wondering if he was, you know.
And what did Scott think about Riverside racing there?
Same. He's the same. It is the track. It's probably, you know, one of the top three tracks in North America that I've ever run at. It's just fun to be at. It's a nice place to be. And, you know, with Donald and John when he was alive and Donald, I mean, they're just top-rate guys. They're just nice people. They're good, and the family supports the racing. And you never, as I said, it's very hard to own a race track and race at it and not really agitate people and have problems. And both John and Donald have been able to do that, and they're the only people that I've run into North America, and I've run into a lot of track owners that raced at their own tracks, and it never went good. I don't think anybody ever had any kind of a mean thought toward or had any doubt that everything went right, and racing at that racetrack, even though they were running at their own track, and that's got to be one of the hardest things that you could ever do.
When was the last time you raced at Riverside? I know you raced over multiple decades. You raced in the Pro Stock Tour. When was the last time you raced at Riverside?
Probably driving a sportsman car probably 3 or 4 years ago now, but I've been in and out of. I don't run late model stuff anymore. I'm just too old to do that. But I still run sportsman class once in a while. Actually, I'm building a brand new car for myself right now for next year. I'm going to run a few times, but I think it was 3 or 4 years ago that I ran Andy Gnish last.
So, are you saying that you could be making an appearance at Riverside this summer?
I don't know. That we haven't figured out a schedule where I'm going to be exactly. I'm going to pick 4 or 5 races and try to get them in this year, and I haven't really decided yet where they would be, but it is a possibility.
I guess from a technology standpoint, because you said your first car was a 50s car, and then you move on to some of the modern sportsmen and late models. The difference is moving from car to car decade over decade. What was that like?
It's just, again, it's a, you learn everything on one, and then you go to the other. Like race cars, basically you've got 4 wheels and 4 shocks and 4 springs, with tires on them, and that's the same no matter what class you go in. But now, like I used to describe it back in the early days, you'd stand back and look at the front of the car, and if both wheels looked straight, it was good. And then 10 years later, you'd kind of tit a tape out, and if they were within a half inch of being straight, you were fine. Now you're down to thousandths of an inch. And instead, when I run Ontario in the 80s and in the Maritime, I was running 4 times a week. Now you're hard-pressed to run once a week because it takes so much more technology. It's so much more complicated. The fine line of being fast and slow now is really narrow. And in the old days, you were running more by the seat of your pants than anything. And we tried stuff now. If you told some people what I tried, they'd think I was crazy. But now the technology out there is instant. It's on the internet. You can find out anything you want about racing. Anybody tries something new, you might have it new today that nobody knows about, but by tomorrow the whole world knows about it. So it's changed dramatically.
And you think that anyone could maybe roll up to a Riverside because we have the Mini Stock Tour, we have the Legends, and some of the younger drivers in the Maritimes come to a behemoth of track. What would you like recommend for advice?
Use your head. You know, it always go slow down and go fast, I guess. And it's just basically, you know, patience. Everybody, you know, pretty well every driver out there at one time or another had a sign pasted on their dash in front of them, patience, patience. And at the race car drivers are big egotistic people. The egos are bigger than they are, every one of them, no matter who you talk to, they're all are. And there it's just trying to control that and being sensible. And as I always said, once you strap the helmet on, most of them go brain dead. So it's kind of, it's just using your head and being sensible, I guess.
Speaking of drivers, I kind of want to do a name game with you. I want to just throw some racing legends in the Maritimes that raced at Riverside. And I just want you to give me some thoughts of racing them at Riverside. Are you ready?
Okay.
Junior Hanley.
Outstanding would be the first word and the simplest word I think I could describe him.
Rolly McDonald.
Rolly's persistent. Rolly kept at it for years. He ran, and then when he got hooked up with Peter Sutherland back with the Dodge, then he became a winner. And Rolly has been like me. He's been there forever.
Don Biederman.
It's like Jekyll and Hyde. He could be the funniest guy in the world, holding court and having everybody laughing, to losing his mind and control and trying to beat somebody with a baseball bat. You just didn't know which day it was going to be. But to get one thing, he was the most talented driver in Canada in traffic that I ever run against.
Because he ran NASCAR too, right?
He ran NASCAR and he ran in Ontario steady and a lot of that. He ran it as a business. That's how he made his money, and he ran it as a business. He knew how, and he teamed up with Junior when he went to Ontario, and he taught Junior Hanley how to make money racing. And even though they separated later and they were big enemies for the rest of their careers, but they both had respect for each other.
Sounds like he had kind of a short fuse.
Yeah, he definitely did that. But talent, he had all kinds of talent.
Greg Seward.
Smoothest driver in the Maritimes that I run against.
John Paul Cabana
was probably the most talented Frenchman driver that I ever run against. I run against him in NASCAR North quite a bit. That's the only time I had anything to do with John Paul Cabana, but he was a bit ahead of my time, but he was a legend in his own.
What was it like racing the NASCAR North Series when they made a stop at Riverside back in the 80s?
That's the same deal where, you know, when you come back to your home track and you've been running NASCAR North, you always want to try to do the best there, and that usually turns out to be your worst day, and that was the way it ended for me, too.
Oh, it didn't turn out so good?
Didn't turn out so good, no.
Finally, John Chisholm.
John Chisholm was a gentleman, a nice guy. He was the normal, just like you and I, and he never, you know, he never showed whether he had money or not money. I know a friend of mine from Maine was coming up to a big race, and he was talking. He stopped, and I had a service station up here in Shuby, and he stopped there on the way to the racetrack, and I was telling him, well, you're going to see this guy come in. There's going to be a hauler come in with two cars, one on the back of the ramp truck and one on a trailer, and a few minutes later, you're going to see a helicopter land in the infield. This guy's going to jump out, and he owns those cars. Well, that was John Chisholm, but he didn't do that to show off. He had jobs in Cape Breton and Newfoundland, and the only way he could make it to the racetrack was to come in his helicopter and get out. But my buddy from Maine, when it happened, he came over to me and said, you weren't kidding. I said, no, I wasn't. But no, they've done so much for racing. John did everything for racing. And when he bought the track back, I was talking to him at the racetrack, and he said, people, you know, after he spent millions of dollars upgrading it, and he said, people say to him, why did you do that? He said, this is my golf course. I don't play golf. I like racing. So this is what I spend my money on.
And what was it like coming back to Riverside after the renovations?
It was really, you know, you were kind of in awe of the place, and you had a lot of expectations. And when you got there, it's one of the few times when, you know, somebody does rebuild the place or redoes something and supposed to be great, and you get there, and it's not, you know, it's not what you really thought. When you're going back this time, it was better than you ever expected, and it was a thrill. I mean, I was so glad to see that track come back to where it has come back to.
Is there any other notable drivers that come to mind when you think Riverside?
Joey Baker, Bobby Allen. Bobby Allen was the best driver at Riverside ever, and he was better than Junior Hanley. He was better than Don Biederman. He was better than Earl Ross. And Joe Baker was one of the guys that, just a nice guy that raced years and years ago. He's still there. He actually works for Chisholm's now, if he hasn't retired by now, but he did the last I talked to him. And those, believe it or not, are the two things that come back to mind.
And over the years, What is your favorite memory of Riverside International Speedway?
I guess standing in Victory Lane after the race was, and Scott won and I was second. That was probably the biggest memory for me.
In 1997?
Yeah.
Was it a bit bittersweet? You come so close and the engine fails on you, but you said that it was really special for you, right?
It was special to be there standing that way, but I was pissed off that I wasn't first and he was second.
What do you think about Riverside being open for 50 years and still going strong?
It's probably, I don't know, but if you look into it, I imagine it's the oldest running track in the Maritimes. I can't think of any tracks that have run that. And actually, you know, I'd be surprised in Canada if there's many that's, you know, probably Flamborough maybe in Ontario has run that long, but there's not many tracks that have run that long and are still one of the top facilities in the country. Sometimes track run forever and get run down, they kind of survive, but that isn't what Anticanish did. Anticanish, they've went to the next level. Each time it's needed, they've gone to the next level.
And will we see you floating around the track this year?
Oh, yes. I it's one of them deals. I said it's worse than drugs. You can always get out of drugs, but you can't get out of racing.
Frank Frazier, we appreciate you joining on the third episode of Victory Laps, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway.
Well, I appreciate remembering me. My granddaughter said, "How come they're interviewing you?" I said, "Well, probably because I'm one of the last guys that's still alive that raced there the first time."
And you're one of the best.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of people might doubt that statement. But anyway, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Paul McLean is the general manager of Riverside International Speedway. He's here to chat about a couple of things, new items about the 50th anniversary. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, how you doing? I hope everybody's enjoying all this cold weather we've been having this winter, but it's on its way out.
I think we want racing. I think we all want racing.
Yes, for sure. I think people are getting the bug.
And the first race coming up is on June 8th, and it's almost what is old is new again with the Triple 50s presented by Kaylee Honda.
Yeah, we decided we wanted to do something a little different to celebrate our 50th anniversary this year. So we come up with this scheme, and we hope that the people enjoy it. And I think it's going to shake things up a little bit, and we'll make it a little more exciting for that day for sure.
And from a fan's perspective, you know, what can they expect with a Triple 50 format?
Well, I guess it's somebody getting out front early in the early laps and leading the whole race, it just won't happen, right? Because just the way it's planned, at the end of each 50, we're going to do a little random draw, I think is what the plan is right now, and the top of the field could be inverted, and the draw will be, where the draw happens is how far back we'll invert, and we'll do that at each 50-lap segment.
And for the drivers, too, there's a little bit of money on the line as well to try and hang up front as much as you can.
Yeah, we want them to race. We don't want them just to hang around and hope that they're going to get flipped to the front, so we put some money on the line, and again, it's just we're just doing this for the first race. There's no plans to do what NASCAR does, segment racing. We just thought we'd do something a little different to shake it up for our 50th anniversary.
No, it's great for the throwback anniversary. And then looking forward to the IWK 250 Super Race weekend, pretty big announcement about the tailgate party.
Yeah, we're excited. We thought we'd want to, you know, bring somebody in special or a little special, something special for this, again, being the 50th anniversary. So got a hold of Matt Minglewood, and I seen him over the holidays in Moncton, and he put on an unbelievable show. And I said, he said he'd be really good. And, you know, we talked, and lo and behold, we have him booked.
It's going to be a kitchen party.
Yeah, I think he puts on a good show. I think people will enjoy it. I think those that are Matt Minglewood fans, I think we'll have people there just to come to see the concert, be honest with you. I think he puts on a great show. There's an open practice that afternoon/evening, and then right after the practice, we pack up the gear and get out of there, and Matt's concert is from 10 o'clock till midnight, and we have a beer gardens in the infield, and it's a lot of fun. It's been growing each year, and we expect to be a good crowd this year again.
That brings us into the IWK 250 weekend when the racing starts up. For any fans out there who haven't really finalized any plans, where can they go to get everything all prepped up?
RiversideSpeedway.ca, our website, has everything there. You can buy tickets now. We're doing something a little different there. We're allowing people to buy tickets early. Some sections are sold out already. So I would advise if you're like sitting in a certain area that you get online and book your tickets. Camping, same thing. We're right now in full form renewing campsites I think probably three quarters of those that were there last year have renewed. And the last check, we're at about 70 people on a waiting list. So if you haven't booked your site or renewed your site yet, I suggest you go on and get it done right away. We should be able to accommodate everybody, even the waiting list. We do have a big field, overflow field that we put, I think, 40 or 50 in last year. And we're hoping that we get it again this year. So if you didn't book a campsite and you're looking for a campsite, or you had a campsite last year, go on our website and get your renewal in as soon as you can.
That's Paul McLean, the general manager of Riverside International Speedway. Thanks for hopping on Victory Laps, Paul.
You're welcome.
Big thanks again to both Paul McLean and Frank Frazier for hopping aboard Episode 3 of Victory Laps. You heard Paul. If you want the same campsite you had last year at the IWK 250, go online to riversidespeedway.ca and renew your campsite. And yes, the godfather of East Coast Blues, Matt Minglewood, will be rocking the Blues away on July 18th at the IWK 250 tailgate party. If you get your weekend pass, the concert's included. And if you just want to check out the concert, tickets are $20 and weekend passes are available now. IWK 250 lap sponsor packages are now available. If you would like to sponsor laps in the 2019 IWK 250 presented by Steve Lewis, you can go to riversidespeedway.ca and fill out the order form. But do it now, because once they're gone, they're gone. June will be here before we know it. The Kaylee Honda Triple 50s is on Saturday, June 8th, alongside the Napa Sportsman Series. Mark it on your calendar. And for the latest information, you can subscribe to the newsletter, giving us a like and follow on Facebook and Twitter, and online at riversidespeedway.ca. This is all part of the 50th anniversary celebrations for Riverside, and you're going to be finding more tributes, a lot more trivia on our website and social media pages. It's all geared to pay tribute to those who have made a significant contribution to our history. And if you have a suggestion, hey, we'd love to hear it. You can send your old photos or videos, particularly from 1969 to 1989, by emailing them to info@riversidespeedway.ca. The checkered flag is waving, and that'll do it for episode number 3. I'm Dylan Langille, and thank you very much for checking out Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway.